Hello, this is Rory Groves, and you are listening to a recording from the Iowa Homeschool Conference in 2022. If you'd like to listen to more recordings from our events, please visit our website at gatherandgrow.us.
So I'm going to be talking today about the economics of self-sufficiency. We'll work for food. My name is Rory Groves, and that's my awesome family there. I have five children, ages 11 to 2. The oldest couple are with us here. You've probably seen them at our booth if you've wandered around the exhibit hall. That's my wife, Becca, and we've been married for 16 years, right, honey?
Yep.
And if you can't tell from the picture, or if you couldn't tell from Becca, we are expecting another farmhand. We are due in August for our sixth child. It was about a year ago that Becca and I were at a homeschool conference. We were at the Minnesota Homeschool Conference. And we kind of had pretty much settled that, that's about what we can handle, and we're going to be, for the most part, I think this seems about right for us. Does this seem right? Yeah, I think we're about done there. But then, you know, there's so many great families at these homeschool conferences, aren't there? And they have these 8 and 9 and 10 kids, and it's like, and they're all well-adjusted, contributing members of society. So we're coming back from the conference, driving home, and we're having this conversation about kids. Should we have more kids? And, you know, we kind of ran out of reasons why we shouldn't have more kids, you know. So here we are expecting our sixth child now, not quite a year later. And when people come and ask us, you know what causes that, right? I say, yes, homeschool conferences. So watch out. So I wrote a book about historical family-centered professions called Durable Trades. And by the way, we have copies left. And if you, he's got one right here. So if you have any interest in this for you or your student or for a friend that might be interested, we'll be closing up shop here right after this talk. I think they shut down at 5, so pretty much right when we're done here. If you could rush down, and we'll be there for a few minutes following. We also publish a quarterly newsletter, which some of you have, and if you don't have it, you can get on our mailing list, and we'll send one off to you as soon as we get home. We have a few more at home. And we also like to host events at our farm. So that's a picture on the screen of a mother-daughter day camp we just held a couple weeks ago. My wife, Becca, led that, and we brought moms and daughters together to really enjoy the farm for a day and to also learn and be encouraged and discipled in the Word. We're going to be doing a similar thing for dads and sons in about 2 weeks. It's called Mighty Faithful Fathers and Mighty Sons. And we want to really build up that vision in fathers. Really developing a family vision where they can bring their families into it and also have some fun on the farm and do some things together. So be praying for us about that, because this is a new ministry for us, as I've mentioned, and we are just really excited to get the word out and to really bless people with the things we have been blessed with. I wanted to share with you today about some of the experience that we've had about learning to homestead over the years. And I know that I've talked to a lot of you are in this room. You have some of these same desires on your hearts. And we are not experts. Our expertise is that we're not experts. Not experts. So we like to say, if we can do it, you can do it. But one of the things that we can add is that we have been at it for a few years now, and we have learned some lessons in the school of hard knocks. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the economics of self-sufficiency, basically meaning how to make things work financially. Because this is the one thing that comes up. If there's one question, people will come up to me and they'll look at me and say, you know, my husband and I, we've been having these conversations and we've been talking about it, and there's this and this and this and this. And they'll just look at me and say, how? You know, that word, how. And I know exactly what you mean when you ask the word how. How do you get across this obstacle of a full-time salary job to living on a farm, acreage, with your family, doing something together for what would be a very meager existence compared to what your skill sets are. You're not going to just walk into a farm and command a high salary. So how do you make that transition? And the thing that I want to talk about is that it's just a very different way to live. And we have this buy and consume mindset that we've all grown up with. But you have to approach this life completely differently when you move into it. So there's an old order Amish friend that I've recently made, which is like a feather in my cap. I think this is the coolest thing. But we've been writing, and I had a conversation with him, and he said, the whole point is to make a living, not a killing. He said, you may not have a lot of money, but you will be wealthy. So going into it, you know, I want to talk a little bit about the justification for work. My background is as a computer programmer, and so moving out to the farm, and an entrepreneur too, I was self-employed, I was always trying to think of ways to make our farm productive. And one of the things I figured out right away was how difficult it was going to be to replace my income as a computer programmer with farming activities. For example, how many eggs would I have to sell at $3 a dozen to replace that income as a computer programmer? A lot of eggs. So there's just a tremendous amount of work that goes into homesteading and hobby farming, farming. And, you know, one of the things is you're always trying to keep the animals where they're supposed to be. My wife likes to say farming is just fencing. And she's going to be making T-shirts someday that say farming is just fencing. And once you've been there, you know what we're talking about. But while writing this talk, in fact, my daughter walked into my office and she said, Dad, the chickens got out of the chicken tractor again. So I actually had to stop while I was writing this line and go out and help her put the animals back in their proper fences. So there's those kind of interruptions. You get these situations where you have injured animals or there's medical needs. You know, Becca and I had to help deliver goat kids this year for the first time in, I don't know, maybe 8 years, 7 years. How long have we had goats? We've never had a complicated delivery yet, but we did, where we had to call a vet out first, and then we had more complicated deliveries, but we had learned how to do it. And we had to, like, you know, well, I'll spare you the gory details, but let's just say everyone survived and we learned something. But that wasn't on the agenda that day. And that's part of the hard work of farm life. Bottle feeding lambs. So there's Becca holding triplet lambs, and aren't they cute? I mean, my goodness, who wouldn't want to go into farming when you see these cute little lambs? Well, there's a story why they're sitting here in this box and Becca's holding them is because their mother rejected, she had triplets, she rejected all three of them, which is a class 5 disaster on a farm because it means bottle feeding every 3 hours for the next 6 weeks, all night long, you know, 3 to 4 to 6 hours. And so it's a, oh no, disaster kind of a thing. We actually were fortunate to have a family that helped. They took them off our hands for a couple of those weeks and bottle fed them for us. But there's just, you know, harvesting from the garden, preserving the harvest. You grow, you know, you put all this food in the ground. You're very excited. Any gardeners in here that, okay, yeah, look at that, great. It's a lot of work putting that garden in, right? So then, you know, and you're weeding it, right? You're keeping up with it as best you can. I mean, it's just relentless with those weeds. Everyone knows. And then the harvest finally arrives, and you're kind of like, well, I'm actually kind of busy today. I can't quite get to that. Why did we plant so many tomatoes? And why are they coming right? I only need a couple tomatoes today. I don't need, 30 or 40 tomatoes. So now we got to start harvesting the tomatoes. We don't want it to go rotten while we're waiting to harvest it. And so you have to can the tomato. Oh, there's a whole new process. Now we got to water bath these things. We got to clean out the jars, sterilize it, find shelves. Where did we put those lids? Are we out of lids? When are they going to have lids stocked back in the store again? We thought ahead this year. We bought like a bulk package of canning lids in March. Yes, heads are nodding. Yes, we've been down this road before. So just a tremendous amount of work, but tremendous benefits as well, right? There's the obvious examples of a healthier lifestyle, better and healthier food, opportunities to work together as a family like we've been talking about, unlike any other profession, really. I'll share this. This is, that's a real picture, by the way. Does that look pretty good? This is a journal entry I wrote some time back, and I said, "This morning I ate a simple breakfast from the produce of our farm, steak and eggs and asparagus. The eggs came from our free-range chickens. The asparagus was picked fresh from our garden. The steak came from another homesteading family in our church, from whom we buy our annual supply of grass-fed beef. Not only is this meal healthy and delicious, it supports another family in our community, enabling them to pursue a more self-sufficient life. If this meal were to be served at a restaurant, it would be fancy fare and expensive. If this, in truth, it would be nearly impossible to find this meal with ingredients picked fresh this morning at any restaurant for any price." And this is part of the economy of self-sufficiency. Now, I don't eat steak and eggs every day, although we do have quite a bit of eggs and asparagus. I'll say, when asparagus is in season, that stuff just does not quit. And without grocery stores, we would not survive the winter. I'm not fully self-sufficient off our own land right now, but we're moving in that direction. And every year is a step towards that. We've been at it for 10 years, and we've learned a lot. And we're not there yet, but we've moved a lot of mileage in the right direction. You know, I had a friend, in terms of that, it's a lot of work. That's actually a direct quote. I had a friend one time when I told him I was moving out to the country. I said, "I want to tap my own maple trees." And he was a farmer out in the country, right? And he's like, you know, here comes another city bumpkin coming out to the... And I said, "I want to tap our own maple trees. I'm really excited about doing this, something we learned about, you know, before we moved here. And we've got the maple trees on our property, so I'm super excited about this." And he was just quiet for a minute, and he said, "That's a lot of work." You know, I mean, how much cheaper is it to buy from the grocery store, right? We think about these things. And another friend of mine said, "Growing tomatoes is the best way to devote 3 months of your life to saving $2.17. So I wanted to make the case here this morning, or this afternoon, that there is a lot more value, economic value, to self-sufficiency than meets the eye. That you can't simply look at the price on the grocery store shelves and call that a fair comparison. Back in the 1930s, there was a group of authors that came to be known as the Southern Agrarians. And they would write about and warn about the rise of industrialism. And they would propose the solution was a return to agrarian ideals. Their work continues to impact people today. If you've ever read Wendell Berry, Gene Logsdon, Alan Carlson, you have been reading a continuation of their philosophies. These authors wrote in a periodical in the first part of the 20th century called Free America, where they debated all these different topics about agrarianism and tried to figure out an economic approach to the modern challenges of farming that would still retain the agrarian ideals. And the periodical ran basically until the Second World War. So basically, during the Great Depression, up until the Second World War. And this book, Land and Liberty, is a compilation of those periodicals. It was written by a friend of mine, Alan Carlson. It was edited by Alan Carlson. And it's a very interesting book if you want to thumb through what people were thinking and talking. You know, it actually, we're talking about a lot of the same things. The how, right? How do we do this? They were talking about these things. The difference was they were still living it. And they were trying to hold on to and preserve and protect against the rise of the industrial and factory mentality. So this is from the preface of the book. Oh, I'm sorry, before I say that. In these articles, the key thing that they were talking about was the difference between exchange value, what we commonly refer to as the price of a product, and use value, which is the usefulness of having that product. So this from the preface of the book. The so-called science of economics back in the 30s had, they believed, gotten off to the wrong start by taking exchange value as its primary subject matter. As a result, it measured a country's wealth in terms of commodities. and committed itself to an economy in constant motion, as things exchange, accumulate, and slip from our grasp. The real wealth of a country, they argued, does not reside in the hectic exchanges of the stock market or the rivers of commodities that flow through every household without belonging there. It resides in the local communities, in the work that holds them together, and the deep investment represented by a home, a place, in the endowment across generations of human love. In such a community, things exchange, but for their use value rather than their price. So going back to my example of the maple syrup, so my friend was right. It is a lot of work. You know, in any tree tappers here? I don't know how far down the maple species reaches. It's pretty much only grows in pretty far northern climates. But so, you know, we tap the trees in, I'd say, late February, maybe mid-March. We're collecting sap in buckets. So it's basically just as the winter is thawing and the temperatures are rising. 5-gallon buckets are set next to every tree that's tapped. Then we have to haul those buckets into like a snowbank that's over up by the house where we have our evaporator set up. After we collect about maybe 30, 50 gallons of sap, we'll fire up the evaporator for a day, usually on the weekends. Then we have to have wood to fire our evaporator. So sap, by the way, is 97% water. That's on a good tree, meaning it has a high sugar content if it's 97% water. So we have to boil most of that water off. And that takes a long time, and it takes a lot of wood. So we got to split wood. And then we got to tend the fire. And Becca enjoys tending the fire. I've delegated that job. She enjoys the steam facial all day, sitting by the evaporator. But it's a long process. You got to feed that fire all day long, keep a rapid boil. And then you're not done. Then you take it off the evaporator when it gets close to done. Then you bring it in the house in a smaller pan, and you finish it. It's called finishing the syrup. Because if you evaporate it too far, and it's hard to control a wood fire, you will have the syrup will reduce to, you know, too thick, and it'll reduce to basically sugar, and then the sugar will reduce to char, and then the char will reduce to a flaming inferno on top of the evaporator pan. Don't ask me how I know that. So you bring it inside the house, or you can control it on an easy control range, and you're monitoring the temperature, and it's 217 degrees, you know, then it's syrup. And then you stop, then you put it into bottles, and you cap it off, and you put it, you know, on the shelf and all that good stuff. The cost of a pint of pure maple syrup at Costco is $15. So the use value of my maple syrup is worth a lot more than $15. I don't know how else to explain it to you, but I am not going to go get rich selling that stuff for $15. To us, it's basically priceless. It's our annual supply of sugar, and it's right from our own trees, and we make priceless family memories, bringing the whole family into this. We have pictures of or a video, I think, on YouTube we did one year, and we're dragging around our little toddler in a sled as we go around from tree to tree and tap them for maple syrup. So we don't sell it at all. We keep it for ourselves, or sometimes we give it as gifts. And if you ever receive a jar of maple syrup from us, just know we really like you. For us, it just simply doesn't reduce to what the market deems fair value. So that's one example. Plus, as long as we have maple trees, we'll always have maple syrup if we're willing to put the work in to obtain it. And because maple trees produce more maple trees, we'll probably always have it. The same cannot be said about products on grocery store shelves, which brings me to my next point, food security. Oh, I had a nice picture of that the whole time. I didn't show you guys. Doesn't that look nice? That's our own maple syrup. By the way, the ambers in that, where you see the really honey gold and it's different. Does anyone know why that is? Different colors of maple syrup? It's how late in the season it's tapped. So the early stuff, they call that grade A amber. Sometimes you might hear that. That's very early in the season. And as the season progresses, you get darker and darker sap to actually where it gets, you have to pull the taps when the trees start to leaf out. They call that buddy sap. And it gets so earthy, it kind of gets bitter tasting and it ruins the sap. You can't taste it in the sap, I mean, it ruins the syrup because you can't taste it in the sap. It's too diluted. But when you concentrate it down into syrup, you can taste the bitterness. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. Little side note. Okay, my first reason why you should work for food is this. When you grow your own food, you own the supply chain. That's the largest component of the cost savings you see in the grocery store. When you buy your food, you are renting someone else's supply chain. When you work for your food, you're an owner. With the notable exception of toilet paper, most serious homesteaders were minimally affected by the supply chain shortages over the last few years. They had their own supply chains. When you're renting the supply chain, you're trading a cheaper price for a lot of unknowns. Will the supply chain be there when I need it? What's the quality of the product shipping through that supply chain? How humanely are the animals and the people treated in that supply chain, and so forth? And you don't know because you don't own it. We've had cyber attacks on meat processing plants, shutting down food supplies and increasing prices, by the way. Who would have thought that hackers in China or Russia or North Korea could prevent you from buying beef or dictate the prices you pay for it? Now we have inflation heating up. Inflation only affects exchange value goods. If you're raising your own food on your own land, you aren't experiencing inflation or the debasement of your money on those items, at least not to the extent that you're relying on your own land. We went out for supper last night and pulled up to the Chick-fil-A drive-thru and just about fell out of my chair when I saw the prices of a single chicken sandwich. Like, what's the cheapest thing on the menu here? And the guy said to me, you know what's been happening to chicken prices lately, right? I said, no, we raise chickens. I have 100 broilers at home right now. I have no idea what's going on. And that's true. We haven't really been affected by meat price increases because we raise all of our own as much as we can. We're affected by some of it, like the feed costs and things like that, but it's nowhere near as affected as the price of a chicken sandwich at Chick-fil-A. So when you own the supply chain, you are raising food for your own family. You're not as vulnerable to hackers or pandemics or inflation. In fact, you have a major inflation hedge, food. People may cut back on vacations or Netflix or other useless luxuries, but they won't stop buying food. When I was researching for my book, I looked at the Great Depression a little bit. And one of the things I observed was that families who lived on farms during the Great Depression would often relate that they never knew they were in a depression. Their pantries were stocked, their homes were heated, they still had jobs. Their wealth was standing in the barns, in the fields, and in the accumulated knowledge of generations. Irresponsible speculation in the markets did not collapse their stock. That's one of them that didn't join us this weekend. This is Alden milking our goat. We have a few milking goats that provide all of the milk we need for a family of seven. They graze for free on the forest brush and in the winter and on hay we cut from our field in the summer, over winter. Sorry, they graze for free on brush in the summer and in the winter we give them hay from our field. We take care of them and they take care of us. In the off season, we buy milk from a local dairy farm down the road. And we actually are talking about getting our own milk cow soon. So stay tuned for some more adventures from the Grovestead. The point is, it's not just the price tag in the grocery store that should be compared. It's the price of the entire supply chain from farm to fork, because that's what you own when you have a homestead. Number two, second reason to work for food is to help create and participate in the community economy. Homesteaders who cannot supply all of their own needs often live nearby others who can. They can be part of a community of independent families and interdependent families. For example, I just mentioned that we buy beef from a family in our church, and that works great for us. We know how they raise it. We see the beef cattle when we're visiting their home for the evening fellowship. We also, as I mentioned, on the off season, we will buy milk from a dairy farm down the road. These are just a couple of ways of where, you know, things that we don't raise ourselves, we can find other community members who are, and we're supporting them. If you're not currently in a place where you can do much growing or keeping your own animals, even if you're in an apartment, by the way, you can still grow. We grew tomatoes in an apartment balcony. I don't recommend chickens in an apartment, though. I wouldn't. So if you do know someone, you can buy directly from them, and that would certainly help build redundancy in the supply chain. Michael Pollan says, he wrote the book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, a very interesting book about the food system. He says, shake the hand that feeds you. Get to know local farmers and buy from them direct. You'll be increasing your own food security and contributing to a stronger supply chain. We want parallel and redundancy in our supply chain. This creates more stable communities and more stable societies. And trust me, when food becomes scarce, like it has been at times in the last couple of years, it will be the existing customers who the farmers serve first. For example, when we were raising chickens, well, we raise chickens every year, mostly for our own family, but then we raise some to sell. My phone started ringing off the hook in 2020 when chickens were sold out at the stores. We turned pretty much everyone down because we only had so much freezer space and we only have so many customers, and we had already raised the chickens for them, so we were not able to take any more customers at that time. This historically is how all self-sufficient communities operated. Most families grew most of what they needed for themselves. Whatever was extra was sold to the community. I mentioned in the talk on homesteading as a school subject, there's a book called Oxcart Man. Has anyone heard of that book before? It's a children's storybook. That is a phenomenal book about that self-sufficient farm. And in terms of communicating a lesson about how a family, it's super simple. I mean, it's like 10 pages, but it's poetically illustrates. It's a family who creates what they need for themselves, and then as a secondary to that, they bring the extra to the market and sell to buy a couple things that they can't make for themselves. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, the society was, with few exceptions, a rural population, and the material for clothing was grown on the home farm and spun and woven by the women. Every household was a self-producing and self-sustaining community. Today, we practice the opposite. We convert everything we can to cash, then we try to buy at the lowest price possible. This approach destroys communities, it destroys supply chains, and it destroys self-sufficiency. It destroys community because we no longer come to depend on each other, and need drives community. When we don't need each other, we drift apart. Wendell Berry writes, "If there is no household or community economy, then family members and neighbors are no longer useful to one another. When people are no longer useful to one another, the centripetal force of family and community fails, and people fall into dependence on exterior economies and organizations. The hegemony of professionals and professionalism erects itself on local failure, and from then on, the locality exists merely as a market for consumer goods and as a source of raw material, human and natural." It destroys supply chains because it funnels all of our energy, all of our output, into the largest possible supply chain. So when we're constantly trying to convert everything into cash, the second reason is that it destroys supply chains. And the largest possible supply chain will always be the cheapest because it's the most efficient. But efficiency and stability are not the same thing, as we found out in 2020, and we will continue to find out going forward. Redundancy is stable, and we would do well to have many supply chains. And third, it destroys self-sufficiency because it leads us into dependence on corporations to earn our income and to spend it. Many conventional farmers today, farming thousands of acres, are wholly dependent on large agribusiness corporations. Think about that. Despite farming thousands of acres, most of them do not grow enough food to feed their own family. And I'm not picking on farmers. I mean, I'm in Iowa here. Don't start throwing tomatoes. Not to pick on farmers, because without them, we'll all starve. That 2% of the population feeds the rest of us. But I just use them as an example of how pervasive this mindset has become in our culture, to convert all of our labor, all of our resources, and all of our energy into exchange value. I have no problem with a little whimpering baby, by the way. This is our life. It feels like I'm right at home. Cry away, sweetie. Oh. Third reason to work for food is liberty. We also, as we destroy self-sufficiency, we destroy liberty, which is my final reason why you should work for your own food. Thomas Jefferson said, "Cultivators of the earth are the most valuable citizens. They are the most vigorous, the most independent, the most virtuous, and they are tied to their country and wedded to its liberty and interests by the most lasting bonds." He also said, "Dependence begets subservience and venality, suffocates the germ of virtue, and prepares fit tools for the designs of ambition." Liberty and independence derive from self-reliance. Liberty was achieved and propagated by cultivators of the earth because they don't need government. They don't need corporations. They were self-governing. The pressures of tyranny were easily restrained because families and communities governed themselves. They didn't depend on faraway bean counters or government bureaucrats to order their lives. And as I shared this morning, would our country ever have won independence from Great Britain if 98% of our population was wholly dependent on the empire and unable to provide their own needs? I don't think so. I doubt we would have even declared independence, let alone would win a war. So it was John Adams, I believe it was, who said that our Constitution was created for a moral and religious people, and it is wholly inadequate for the governing of any other. That's a good quote. However, it was also created for an agrarian people, a self-sufficient people, not a people who were completely dependent on government largesse or on corporate largesse. So liberty derives from self-reliance. It's not about who gets elected president. If we want liberty again, we need to become more self-sufficient, and that includes working for food. So historically, just to recap, families historically sought to produce everything they needed first. Then they would barter for what they could. And third was money. Money was rare and used only for things that could not be bartered, or as a way to preserve and save for future needs, for in a way that crops could not. For example, you couldn't necessarily store crops for years and years and years. So money would come into play in that third option. But it was very much a distant third. The first focus was on self-sufficiency. The point is that they did not seek to convert the primary results of their labor into cash. Money was last, if at all. The focus was on subsistence, first and foremost. Lastly, when you work for food, you are a producer. You can start building and participating in the barter economy. And this is going to be very important going forward. It's interesting, when I was researching for my book, I discovered that the barter economy was pretty much the main economy up until the 19th century. There wasn't enough money. There wasn't enough silver and gold to go around. People didn't exchange money, and there weren't banks. I think the first bank wasn't until in the 1790s. So the first 150 years or so of our nation's existence, there were no banks. People exchanged what they produced. They exchanged corn and animals. From the earliest colonial settlements to as late as 1815, people traded in commodities known as country pay because money was so scarce. Surprisingly, considering that none of the modern farming methods existed and harvests fluctuated wildly from year to year, those commodities were a remarkably stable form of currency. From 1640 to 1740, a period of 100 years, the price of corn did not fluctuate more than 2.5 shillings, which is about 50 cents. And in some periods, the price did not change at all in 40 years. How would you like to buy your next iPhone with 60 bushels of corn. But before you laugh, contrast the antiquated country pay with our money today. In the most recent 100 years, through intentional inflation, the U.S. dollar has lost 97% of its purchasing power. But back then, their barter economy was amazingly reliable and stable. It was so stable. So if you look on this chart, I've got from 1633 to 2010, the price of butter. And you can see that up until about the turn of the 20th century, it is well below 25 cents. I think it fluctuates from 12 cents to 25 cents for the first 300 years of our country's existence, give or take. 1913, you see a blip that shoots up, and then it comes back down during the World War I, and then it just starts shooting up like a rocket to now over $4 in 2010. That's inflation. That's caused by the devaluation of our currency. So you actually corn, I heard someone say central banks can't grow corn. Corn is actually a really good inflation hedge, and so is all food. As fiat currencies collapse, and with it, trust in banks and institutions, we will see a resurgence in bartering. In fact, it has already begun. Communities, and especially Christian communities, would do well to begin practicing some form of barter now. Call it a dress rehearsal. For the last few minutes here, I just want to share some thoughts on more of a personal side. I guess I call this slide the organic family. But these are some reflections that I've had on building a family economy. I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. It's just something that I'm drawn to, is to create and build and explore ideas. And it's something that when you move to a homestead and when you move to a farming culture, it's very different than a computer culture, which I learned right away. You can't force things to grow any faster than God will allow it. And so there are certain things that you just have to surrender to in the pacing and the timing of the family economy. So I do talk to a lot of people who are eager to become self-sufficient, and what they do is typically they look at their current salary and they say, how am I going to replace this $60,000 a year, you know, and start homesteading? You know, how many broiler chickens do I need to raise to replace that income? At how many organic vegetables do I need to sell at the farmer's market to bring in $60,000 a year? And it's just, you got to just put that out of your mind. I mean, whatever it is that you're doing right now to subsist, I hope I've put some seeds in your heart about there's a different way to think about it. One of the things that I will see often in the country with people, especially who are new to homesteading, is they will be burning themselves out trying to squeeze profits out of their farm too soon, trying to do too much too fast. They're leaving the rat race and jumping into another. They're turning their dream into a job. And you know what happens with those farms, by the way? The kids take off at the earliest opportunity. You're not creating a multi-generational inheritance that way. You're creating a new way of life. So don't bring an industrial mindset with you to your organic farm. You need to think differently about money, about the land, and about relationships. You know, Jesus said, don't put new wine in old wineskins. Whether you create your organic farm or if it's something completely different, don't forget that your business should be organic too. And by that, I mean it needs to grow at its own pace. Trying to scale up a new family business too quickly is just as synthetic as industrial agriculture, and it's just as damaging. People are part of the natural process. It takes time to build relationships. If you force it and try to squeeze profit ahead of schedule, more than likely you'll do damage to the relationship or you'll damage your soils. Jesus said, "Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit." So focus on building healthy soils first. That might mean that profitability is a long ways off, but that's okay. You're building soil. You know that when they estimate that it takes 100 years to build an inch of topsoil. Now, naturally, for the natural environment to do it. There are ways that you can do it. You can be part of that process and increase the speed at which soil is built up. But it takes, on average, 100 years to build an inch of topsoil. And with modern agricultural methods, we're depleting that in the average about one a year, maybe 1 or 2 inches a year, just through taking off the topsoil, cultivating it, and wind blowing off that topsoil. So when you're building your own business, you want to focus on bringing back healthy soil, healthy culture to your family. When the harvest finally comes, it will be good fruit. And this is more important, it will be sustainable. And I'll say, as someone who chases a lot of visions, because that's just the way I'm wired, I've learned about this concept that I call the loosely held vision. Usually, if I have something that's on my heart, an idea, I tend to grab it so tight. I want to write the business plan, and I want to make it happen, right? What's the step-by-step to do this now? But oftentimes, when God puts that seed on our heart, it's a seed. It's not a destination, right? And seeds take time. It has to grow roots. In other words, most of the growth is underground before it can grow up and produce fruit. So when God puts seeds on our hearts, we can grip it so tight that we don't give it room, right? We have this idea, but we're trying to force it to happen. But it's like we're holding on to it too tight instead of holding it loosely. We can compact the soil, so to speak. Or at least we can delay what God wants to bring about. So this concept of a loosely held vision is something that my wife and I, when we have some idea for our farm, and right now we've talked about this ministry Gather and Grow, and you grab a brochure if you're interested. But someone came up and asked me, "What's your 5 or 10 year vision?" And I know enough to know to say I have no idea what the 5 or 10 year vision. There's some ideas we've got. I'd like to see more chapters of this open up. I'd like to see other families doing similar things. You know, not everyone that we want to reach can come to our farm in Northfield, Minnesota. But I don't know how we're getting there. But it's an idea. I'm just going to let that simmer for a while. I'm going to let that grow underground. We try to be relaxed about it and allow the Lord to develop it over time until we have something actionable to do. You know, I don't know exactly what 10 years looks like, but I do know what I need to do today. I'm usually pretty clear on that. One example is the Grovestead newsletter. This is our kids folding and stuffing our newsletter here. This started as a simple way to share what we were learning from our life in the country, and it started with about 30 friends. Just had this idea. We had gotten another missionary had been sending us a quarterly newsletter, and we were inspired with that. This is digestible in small doses, so I think we could do something like this. That mailing list has grown to over 1,000 people. We started asking for donations a few years ago just to offset the printing costs, but it's very much a break-even operation. The point is that it's something we really value doing. We do it together as a family, and it forces us to reflect on what God is doing through the farming experience and to distill that for others. But if we were looking at this as a profit center, like how can we make money writing a newsletter as a family? There's no way we would be doing this. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It's very expensive and time-consuming, and frankly, it's a little insane. I'm a computer programmer, you know, printing out at the church photocopy machine, printing out these newsletters and sending them in the mail with a stamp, which, by the way, those stamps are going up again in, I think, July, right? Did we catch that? July 7th or something? Happy Independence Day. So we're printing this, publishing this print newsletter in a digital age, but we're just trying it out and trusting and watching and seeing what takes shape and what grows. And from this newsletter have sprung so many amazing fruits, namely the relationships with people like you and others who are walking a similar path, a different path. We get to get prayer requests. If you go to our newsletter on the sign-up page on our website, which we just still, you can write to us too. We have a P.O. box if you want to write and sign up that way. You don't have to use a website, but we ask for prayer requests for your family, and we get these awesome. And I would encourage you, send us your prayer requests. we get the most amazing requests to be really join with these families and petition the throne of God for these life-changing situations. We, every single night, we gather for family worship, and we pull these sheets out, and we pray for these families, and we pray alongside, and we will pray alongside you if you send us your requests as well. But it's just amazing to be a part of that. And then we've had gatherings where we've met people, you know, a lot of the readers in person. And then out of all the writing that we did, just, you know, on a quarterly basis, talking about farming, thinking about it, different questions that would come in and answering those questions, this book came out called Durable Trades that is now a major part of our lives. So that book led to us getting invited down here to the Iowa Homeschool Conference, where we get to meet all of you and start new stories and new journeys and new relationships. So all that to say, allow your family economy to grow at its own pace and don't force it. Paul writes, I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God makes it grow. Don't follow for the lures of quick riches or other synthetic inputs for your organic business. Don't worry about keeping up with what others are doing. You see people doing stuff on YouTube and Facebook and Instagram and websites, and you get just inundated all the time. Look, that's fine. Let people do what they're doing. Don't feel like you can't keep up with what everyone else is doing. It's hard. I get it. I feel the same kind of pull. Like, should we be raising llamas too? I guess there must be something in this. We keep seeing llamas on the... But I just wait. No, Lord, the Lord didn't call us to raise llamas. He called us to do this right now. Really distill that down to what God has put on your heart and just trust the Lord. Try to shut out the distractions and just move forward with your family. Nurture it well, especially relationships, which are eternal. And allow God to bring forth fruit in his own time. And be prepared for the fruit to be different than what you expected. And never forget, your family is the mission. Whatever you do, the business exists to serve the family, not the other way around. If your business ever gets in the way of that, it's time to course correct, scale back, take a break, or shut down until your family regains the priority. And that is that. So I just wanted to share with you, I suppose this is the last talk of the event, and you all know about our newsletter by now, but gatherandgrow.us is our website, or thegrovestead.com. You can sign up for that for free. And then we're only going to be open for a few more minutes here, as far as I know, so it's your last chance. If you haven't gotten the book, please go down and visit our booth. Becca's down there by now. If you want to become a partner with what we're doing, basically, if you found value in us being down here to present this, this is only happens because there are other people out there who want to get this message out. So if this is something that you think is valuable, maybe you're in a position where we had one family that said, we're not in a position to do these things, but we think this is important. And so we want to contribute so that you can help get this message out. We have a gift that we'd love to give you if you want to become a monthly partner at any level. You can visit gatherandgrow.us/give or just come and talk to us, and we'd be happy to partner with you in that way. But pray for us. We'll be praying for you. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share.